listen to some of the lectures. I don't record all of them, but some I record, and I haven't done anything on the Diamond Sutra in a long time. So I thought maybe I'd record this and I'd try to download it. But if you're ever interested, you can go. It's probably about 20 talks that cover a whole range of topics. So we've been studying the Diamond Sutra because I went down, most of you, as I said last week, I went down to L.A. and visited the exhibit at the Getty Museum on the Dunshan Caves, with these 1,000 caves in Cave 17. They found a whole bunch of these sutras and scriptures from many traditions, and the Diamond Sutra was one which actually had been written probably in, I think, about the 2nd century Common Era in southern India, or Madras, and then brought up into China and translated in Chinese, and then the oldest printed book. There were many written books, but this was the first wood-brought printed book, 868. And they found this first printed book. And if you go to London, you can go to the London Museum, and that's where it abides after it finishes in Los Angeles. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background on it. We read a little bit in the Diamond Sutra last week. I want to give you a little bit of background because one of the sutras that we'll chant in here is the Heart Sutra. And the two main sutras in the Zen tradition are the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra. Probably they're the most important because the rest of the Prajnaparamita, 8,000 lines, 18,000 lines, and 100,000. And they're kind of hard to wade through, which I'll explain in a minute. So these are synthesized, the Heart Sutra, into just 32 lines, and the Diamond Sutra, I think, is in 32 paragraphs. So it's pretty short. And the emphasis tends to be very compatible with kind of Zen teaching about the limitations of the thought process and verbal activity and written. In other words, Zen tends to not emphasize those things and tends to emphasize experiential experience, sitting meditation. That's what Zen means. Zen means chan, or sitting practice, meditation practice. That's what the word means. Also, I just wanted to say, in here I've talked in here about the Lojong, the Tibetan Lojong teachings that I teach. Doug is in that class. And there are 59 slogans. And most of those 59 slogans are very practical. They're very easy to, not so easy, but pretty practical. Like the one that I've been working with during the summer is, always maintain a joyful state of mind. So when I'm grumpy or upset, this little slogan goes through, always maintain a joyful state of mind. And it's amazing to me how that helps me drop a fondness for that state of mind. You get in that state of mind and you just want to justify it, right? There's lots of reasons why I can be grumpy. So I always maintain a joyful state of mind. And of course, the Dalai Lama is wonderful in terms of actually exemplifying that, if you've ever seen him. Always, amidst all the suffering of these people, always has this kind of alive state of mind. So, other slogans, 59 slogans, turn all difficulties onto the path, right? Is another one. Difficulty comes up, okay, how can I use this? How can I turn it into the path of wisdom? But in the 59 slogans at the very beginning, there are four major slogans which are called the absolute slogans. And they're very difficult to understand. One is, treat everything as a dream. Explore the nature of consciousness. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion, which means basically keep a beginner's mind. But these beginning slogans they're more metaphysical, and they're based on the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, and the Prajnaparamita Sutra. So why do they give you something at the beginning of these teachings which are so hard to understand? They're not, in some ways, they're not so useful, you could say. They're not so accessible. They're more metaphysical. They, deal with epistemological questions. They deal with issues such as, what is this world? What is the self? What is the other? And so the question with the Diamond Sutra is presenting, as you'll see as I continue to read it a little bit, is it gets you to kind of want to question what is the heart of our anguish? The heart of our anguish is of separation, of feeling separated, feeling alone, right? I'm right, you're wrong, right? The basis of all war. So these sutras are trying to get you to see things in a different way. They're trying to really turn your state of mind around. So that's why. And it's very hard to talk about these things. So before we go on to sort of the practical applications of mindfulness or meditation, all these little, you know, slogans or whatever, why are we doing it? So they're laying the basis, these sutras, and these are particularly, we'll finish with the Diamond. We probably won't visit the Diamond Sutra very much. But the Heart Sutra we will continually revisit in here. Next week we may do a little ceremony that I want to do with you for people that are sick or we have lost, and we'll chant the Heart Sutra. And it's hard to understand the Heart Sutra, so I'm giving you some background about why this is deliberately kind of difficult to do this. But as we penetrate it, it begins to break down the difference between self and other, which is often created by our conceptualization, right? I feel this way, they feel that way, there's a division, right? And in our meditation practice, that's what we're trying. We find, if we continue to meditate, as we still the mind, these dialogues that separate us from everything and people begin to abate, and we begin to integrate. That's the mystical component. That's what happens experientially in your meditation experience, even though you're not always feeling that in the moment. You're in the moment, you're feeling, my mind's so busy, my body hurts. But as you continue to let go of these thoughts and let go, you can begin to experience this. More love. In other words, more love. More connection. So I wanted to I wanted to read you, this is a little bit academic, but hopefully I don't lose you in this. But it sets the tone for what the sutras are trying to do. It says, in fact, their sutra style is a major defining characteristic of the Mahayana movement, the later movement in Buddhism, which Zen came out of. Their surrealistic locations, measured in mind-boggling dimensions and filled with dazzling apparitions, their immense all-star cast of characters, and their sheer extravagance of their language all serve to reassert the primacy of the visionary, shamanistic side of Buddhism that is generally neglected by the Abhidharma. The Abhidharmas were the first, this major school, or meditation, all you looked at was what's a healthy thought, what's a not healthy thought. And they have all these different categories about how to do this. This is like elevating it to a different level. You know, you have all these bodhisattvas and world systems. I mean, you know, we read it in this century and we think, this is like, what is this? This is clearly not real. But they're trying to create something in these sutras. So you've got to go into it with that kind of attitude. Here, the seeming reality of every perception is viewed as a partial, limited way of experiencing the universe, filled with multivariant levels, so varied and complex that what would seem real on one level dissolves into illusion on another. So you'll see in these sutras, they present one thing, but then they totally reverse themselves in the next paragraph. And that's very kind of upsetting for us, that, you know, we like certainty. This has the effect of blurring the line between real and illusory. That's where the shamanistic part comes in. That's what the shaman does. Okay? He brings the unknown world to us. And that's what these sutras are doing. Making language seem totally inadequate for describing the truth, which is one of the emphases of Zen traditions. There's a phrase in Zen that says, a teaching outside the sutras. In other words, don't rely primarily on the sutras, rely on your own experiential experience. In this sense, the style of the expanded sutras makes a graphic case for an assumption that underlies the Mahayana enterprise. Given the complexity of reality and the limitations of language, teaching can serve at best only as skillful means to effect the transformation of the mind of the listener, reader caught in the partiality of particular views. So Suzuki Roshi's second book, which says, not always so, that's the title of his second book, after Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, that's what that says. Not always so. No matter what your thought is or your attitude about anything, always try to cultivate this attitude that's only partially correct. You know? And of course, isn't that what gets us into trouble? It's like, I'm right, you're wrong. Right? And then we go to war. Once the view has been discarded, the teaching designed to cure should be discarded as well, to be replaced by other, perhaps seemingly contradictory teachings appropriate for whatever view, new view, the individual becomes attached to on the next level of practice. This view of language is so dominant in the Mahayana teachings that some texts even assert that the Bodhisattva doctrine itself is simply a skillful means. So whatever you assert, you see it is only limited, and then they'll turn around in the next phrase and not assert. On. Thus, in presenting language as an instrument of deception, it seeks to unmask that deception and the motives that help to perpetrate it. If language functions to structure a homogeneous self and the world, then the sutra functions to expose these two types of mental constructs as contingent and arbitrary. So that's what Buddhist psychology is trying to do. In terms of seeing yourself as, this is right, this is me, we're trying to get you to deconstruct that, to see that you're part of everything and that every truth is just conditional. That's hard for people because we want certainty. A distinctive feature of the Prajnaparamita-inspired literature is the awareness that language is inadequate to express the insights of an awakened consciousness that has managed a total extinction of the ego, self, other, through meditation practice. The Diamond Sutra uses the language to destroy linguistic categories, is intended to produce a liberated cognition, and finds parallels in modern deconstructionalism. So modern deconstructionalism just says whatever is being written is basically a fiction because it's just a partial presentation of something. Let's see what else here. One more paragraph here. The Diamond Sutra, as well as later Zen traditions where the Koan method is used to deconstruct all texts, all preconceived notions of reality. So when I was saying earlier, sensini, don't know mind, create don't know mind, that's what koans are trying to do. That's what these sutras are trying to do, is lead you to rather than I know or certainty, which most religious texts try to do. This is the Bible. This is absolutely true, right? This is the Quran. This is the absolute truth. This is trying to do exactly the opposite of that, which is, I find, incredibly refreshing. You're not going to be able to lock down behind anything. The Mahayana deconstruction aims to free the mind even from its own sense of context. Unlike the aimlessness of literary deconstruction, the aim of Mahayana deconstruction, whether in Zen or other schools, is to awaken the individual to the true nature of reality, not merely to play with words. The overriding concern of the Diamond Church is to use language and reasoning in paradoxical ways to free the listener from the text of language and reasoning so that he or she may advance along new liberated ways of seeing things. So that this holds true for the Heart Sutra. So next time we read the Heart Sutra, and you're thinking, what are they trying to do here? No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Well, of course they're all these things. Well, that's the way they're trying to deconstruct are your way of looking at it. They're trying to say all these things don't stand alone. They're all these things are connected. So last week we started. Buddha went out to the village, gathered his alms, took whatever was offered in a non-preferential way, whatever the world offers us, came back, and then he started to answer Subhuti's, the disciple who abides in love primarily, question. And he says, Subhuti says, how do you practice? How do you train the mind? So instead of getting all these meditation instructions, he gives them the great vow of the Bodhisattva. This is what, don't even think about practicing until you set the intention. What's the right intention? You're not doing this for yourself. So he says, however many species of living beings there are, whether born from eggs, from the womb, from moisture, or spontaneously, whether they have form or do not have form, whether they have perception or do not have perception, whether it cannot be said of them that they have perception or not perception, we must lead all these beings to nirvana so they can be liberated. So your job is not only to help people, but to help everyone, every living thing and non-living thing. What a vision for the second century. I mean, that's just astounding, really, for the second century. We're still trying to just get a grasp of this today. And then he goes on. And when this, so this is where they, says, and when this innumerable, immeasurable, infinite number of beings has been liberated, we do not in truth think that a single being has been liberated. So that right there is an encapsulation of probably the whole Heart Sutra, the whole Prajnaparamita Sutra. And then he goes on. Why is this so, Subhuti? Why is this so? If Subhuti, a bodhisattva, holds on to the idea that a person, a self, a living being, or a lifespan exists, that person is not an authentic bodhisattva. So can you see the paradox that they're doing? First of all, he says, you got to go out and save everybody. And then in the next sentence, he's saying, when in fact there's nobody to save. So these two sentences are the heart of the Mahayana teaching, because it's trying to deconstruct your whole idea of that there's something other. That you, first of all, there's a you that's doing something to something else. So when we were studying, remember the sutra also deals with the paramitas. And the first paramita of generosity, and then the paramita of ethical conduct, and then patience, and then effort, and then concentration. And then the last one was the paramita of praja, wisdom. So this is dealing with the paramita of wisdom, how you have to infuse this last sixth paramita into all the other paramitas. Because if you don't, then you get stuck. I'm giving to you, please, I'm giving you a Dharma talk. Will you please be very grateful to me? You don't seem very grateful to me that I'm giving you this Dharma talk. How come you're not grateful to me? So you can see how I get stuck, right? And we're always getting stuck that way. We give, and there's this little contingent thing where we want that recognition, right? So what the Prajna Paramita is trying to say is, can we keep working where you're just doing it out of a sense of where you're not expecting anything back. You're just doing it. You know, like the bumper sticker, random acts of kindness, that kind of touches at it a little bit. You're not expecting recognition. Just random acts, nobody notices, right? That's what it's trying to encourage. You're just doing it because it's just the right thing to do. You know, you just go around and, you know, pick up trash off the ground, and you don't expect anybody to see that you're doing it, right? Because you just, it's just the right thing to do. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, the right hand, when it helps the left hand, isn't saying, well, I just really want to help the left hand. It's just because it's all part of the one body system. It's just intuitively. So that's where Prajnaparamita and the sutra are trying to take you to. Why is it so? If Subhuti, a bodhisattva, holds on to this idea that a self, a person, or a living being, or a lifespan exists, that person is not an authentic bodhisattva. So we'll